Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jamal Abdi, president of the National Iranian American Council, who explains why he believes President Trump's strategy of escalating confrontation with Iran could soon spin out of control. Tim Carr of the media democracy group Free Press, who talks about why many observers believe the proposed merger between telecom giants T-Mobile and Sprint would hurt low-income consumers and communities of color most. And War Resisters League board member and U.S. Army veteran Ellen Barfield, who discusses the links between climate change, militarism, and war. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a major victory for gay rights in Africa, Botswana's High Court overturned a colonial-era law criminalizing homosexuality. Botswana joined South Africa and Angola in recognizing gay relationships, while 32 other African nations continue to criminalize homosexuality. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the law was seen as a source of violence against the nation's LGBTQ community. In overturning the ban on gay sex, Judge Michael Luburu wrote, "The law must evolve, since the gay ban was a British import and enacted without the consultation of local people." The case was brought by a student, Letsweletse Mochidemong, now 24 years old, who courageously challenged the colonial-era carnal knowledge law. Human Rights Watch LGBTQ researcher Nila Ghoshal hopes the Botswana ruling will inspire activists across the continent, as it makes crystal clear that people's private sexual behavior and morality is not any business of the state. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau endorsed the findings of a 3-year government inquiry which concluded violence against Indigenous women and girls is Canadian genocide. The report concluded that state action and inactions rooted in colonialism and colonial thinking were the driving forces behind the disappearances of thousands of Indigenous women. Although Trudeau did not use the word genocide in his remarks, the government promised to reform police practices and the criminal justice system. An earlier report in 2015 by Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission maintained that forcibly relocating Indigenous children into government schools was cultural genocide. In Canada, Indigenous women make up 4% of the female population, but account for 16% of women who are murdered. The report by the National Inquiry into Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women and Girls calls for expanding shelters for Indigenous women, improving policing in remote communities, and recruiting more Indigenous women to serve on civilian boards overseeing the police. Texas has long been a hotspot for voter suppression tactics. Elected Republican officials have pushed an agenda that includes extreme partisan gerrymandering, onerous photo ID laws, and restrictive voter registration rules, all with the obvious intention of disempowering the state's black and brown voters. In late January, Acting Texas Secretary of State David Whitley, using state ID application data, made the ridiculous claim that 95,000 non-citizens were on the state's voter rolls, and that between 1996 and 2018, 58,000 of them had voted. Whitley instructed all 254 Texas counties to launch a massive purge of the state's voter rolls, removing anyone targeted who did not respond with documentary proof of citizenship. According to the American Prospect, the false claim was made at the urging of Texas GOP Governor Greg Abbott. Abbott and Whitley ignored the fact that many people who were not citizens when they applied for the state ID years ago later became citizens and, like other citizens, properly registered to vote. Demos, the Texas Civil Rights Project, and the ACLU took the state of Texas to federal court over the voter purge. In late February, a federal court ordered Texas to halt the purge. As a result of his failed voter suppression plan, Whitley lost his job when all 12 Democrats in the 31-member Senate voted against moving him into the Secretary of State post, denying him the 2/3 vote required for confirmation. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Following weeks of threats and accusations against Iran by Washington, Tehran's government announced that it expects to soon breach the terms of the 2015 International Nuclear Agreement that limited the amount of enriched uranium the nation produces. This comes more than a year after President Trump's decision to unilaterally withdraw and violate the agreement and impose harsh economic sanctions against Iran. Until now, Tehran had remained in compliance with limits placed on their nation's nuclear program. Last week, two oil tankers in the Strait of Hormuz were damaged by explosions that Washington charged was an attack sponsored by Iran or its proxies. Iran denied the accusation and observed that one of the tankers, owned by Japan, was attacked at the very same time Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was in Tehran for diplomatic talks with Iranian leaders. The highly unlikely scenario that Iran would launch an attack on a Japanese ship during talks with a Japanese head of state prompted many observers to declare the bombing of the ships to be a false flag operation designed to further increase tensions between the U.S. and Iran. Your reporter spoke with Jamal Abdi, president of the National Iranian American Council, who examines the very real danger that Trump's strategy of escalating confrontation with Iran could soon spin out of control and lead to war.
I think that there is a real danger of this triggering a direct military confrontation. I think the fact that the oil tanker attacks and the Trump administration's accusations of an Iranian hand behind them, the fact that it has been met with such circumspection from the international community, from the American public, probably is a good thing, because I could really, you know, this is kind of the scenario that we have feared for years, where, you know, you talk about the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz and the, you know, oil shipments and everything. And there are so many tripwires where somebody makes a mistake and there's a retaliation, and you could see this escalating out of control and becoming an all-out war. And we already know that, you know, the region is in this state of massive tension. We see it, you know, we see it playing out in Yemen. We see it playing out in Syria, this proxy war between, you know, Iran and the groups that it works with. And then on the other side, the Saudis and the Israelis. And so, you know, I think the real fear is that if this doesn't get contained, if this continues to escalate, if we see this continued tit for tat, if you have more U.S. troops entering the region and potentially being exposed to some dangers of, you know, Iran or a proxy, you know, killing U.S. troops or being blamed for it, and then a reaction to that, that you could really see this tinderbox explode. It's particularly disconcerting because we don't know that there is a real apparatus on the U.S. side that is making decisions strategically. It really seems like it is a couple of different players who are really driving the policy in the direction that they see fit. And while people seem to think that, you know, Donald Trump doesn't want a war with Iran, he doesn't want to be a war president, everything he's allowing these guys to do is putting the United States in a position where we're going to have no more options. And if Iran does start to exceed these limitations, I think by next year you could potentially see Iran with the capability to potentially break out and have an undetectable nuclear weapons capability, which is the big fear that helped lead to the talks that eventually got the nuclear deal. And if we get to that point, under Obama, there was a recognition that there had to be an off-ramp and there had to be mutual concessions in order to avoid that. Under this administration, heading into an election, I don't know that they're going to make that calculation.
There's some concern that what's happened to these oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman is a false flag operation, that it's designed to ramp up tension and maybe even trigger a war by somehow engaging the United States in this set of accusations that Iran is being irresponsible, reckless, and launching terrorist attacks on a very important world waterway for oil transit. What are the chances are this was a false flag operation, do you think?
So, like I said, the credibility of this administration is next to nothing. I mean, they lie, you know, every minute of every hour of the day, it seems like. And so I think that's why there are a lot of, you know, even the most, you know, sober-minded analysts, publicly and certainly behind closed doors have been talking about, you know, is there going to be a Gulf of Tonkin incident? Is there going to be a false flag incident? You add to that that, you know, the parties that are really in control here, other than Bolton and Pompeo, it's, you know, the Saudis, the UAE, the Israelis. They have a real vested interest in seeing this policy play out to what the UAE called cutting off the head of the snake, and, you know, taking out the Iranian regime. And so I don't think you can put anything past those folks either, that they would orchestrate something like this that would draw the U.S. into this war. And then the other piece that I have found interesting, partially because my organization has been sort of subject to this, in the past few weeks, it's been revealed that the United States government was actually funding an organization as part of a program that was originally set up to counter ISIS propaganda, particularly on social media, and then was eventually a program that was supposed to counter Russian election interference and propaganda. And now there's an organization that was getting at least $1.5 million called Iran Disinformation Project that was actually attacking critics of Trump's Iran policy, and particularly Iranian-American critics of the policy. So my organization, analysts, even journalists like Jason Rezaian of The Washington Post, and this could be just the tip of the iceberg. We don't know if there is more there, that potentially the government's funding even more groups to circulate these sort of false narratives.
Jamal, tell us what you think the U.S. House of Representatives, controlled by the Democrats right now, what should they be doing right at this moment to slow down this march to war?
The first thing they need to do is they need to make it 100% clear that the Trump administration does not have authorization for this. And there was actually a debate last week in a Armed Services Committee markup on whether to move forward with language that clarifies that Trump does not have the authority to launch a military strike against Iran. That was tabled, but will hopefully be debated on the House floor in the next couple of weeks. There was a little bit of cold feet among some of the Democrats on that, and I think that now it is it really incumbent on them to send that message loud and clear, because if they do not do just that minimal step of clarifying what the law is and sending a message to Trump that, you know, he won't get away with an unauthorized war, I think that they're as responsible for failing to prevent this war. So that's what they need to do, and they need to do it fast.
That was Jamal Abdi, president of the National Iranian American Council. Find more commentary and analysis on the danger that President Trump's policy of confrontation with Iran could lead to war by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The proposed $26 billion merger between telecom giants T-Mobile and Sprint is opposed by a growing number of consumer and citizens groups across the U.S. The combined companies would become the second largest wireless provider in the country. If the deal is approved by the Trump Justice Department, the further consolidation of the wireless phone market would leave only three major carriers in place, which many observers believe would lead to less competition and higher costs for consumers, as well as triggering the elimination of up to 30,000 jobs. In the face of a lawsuit to block the merger launched by 10 state attorneys general, the Justice Department has asked the companies to divest themselves of certain assets as a precondition to approve the deal. The sale of Sprint's discount prepaid wireless service, Boost Mobile, is likely among the concessions that the companies will offer. Your reporter spoke with Tim Carr, Senior Director of Strategy and Communications with the media democracy group Free Press. Here he explains why his group is opposed to the T-Mobile-Sprint merger and believes that if the deal is approved, the biggest losers will be low-income consumers and communities of color.
There have been a number of efforts by carriers or wireless carriers to merge over the last couple of years. People may have remembered when T-Mobile and AT&T tried to merge, and we successfully blocked that merger because a lack of competition, a lack of choice in the marketplace means higher prices and declining services. So we've been successful in the past blocking these types of of what are called horizontal mergers, when you have competitors, direct competitors merging with one another. This latest proposal is to merge the third and the fourth largest carriers, T-Mobile and Sprint, as one entity, and remove the and lessen the number of choices that we have in the marketplace from four to three, the two leading carriers being Verizon and AT&T. And we have been successfully fighting this merger for more than a year now. We were of the understanding that the staff, the antitrust staff, these are the people who are not politicians but career bureaucrats within the Department of Justice, were recommending that the merger not go forward. But unfortunately, the decision is often made in political chambers and not amongst the experts. And so prior to the DOJ making a decision on this, the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, which is also an entity that looks at mergers of this sort, came out. Its leader, Chairman Ajit Pai, announced that he was going to support the acquisition. We saw that as a fairly transparent effort by Pai to try to influence the process. And now we've had conflicting reports in the media that even the Department of Justice may be looking at this merger, and that the political wing at the Department of Justice is supportive in many ways of the merger, that there's some indication that the Trump White House is also supportive of the merger. And so we're concerned that that it may go through. One of the things that's happened in the last week that was really important is that 10 state attorney generals, 10 state attorneys general, said that they're planning to file suit to stop the T-Mobile merger, including some large states like New York and California. And so having attorneys general from states sue to stop this merger is really important. So that's a lot of information for your listeners. But essentially, this merger is still in an uncertain state. Unfortunately, we've made a very sound argument that reducing the number of choices in the marketplace is bad for consumers, and it's especially bad for people of color who rely more heavily on T-Mobile and Sprint and some of their what are called reseller brands like Boost to get online via wireless services. So there's a lot going on. We're very happy that the state's attorneys general have taken a strong stand, and we're hopeful still that this merger will not get approved.
Tim, more recently, I've read that the Justice Department is trying to work out some deal where T-Mobile and Sprint would divest themselves of certain holdings, certain companies, certain spinoff companies, to maybe create a new national wireless competitor that would allay the concerns of opponents like yourself. You can certainly speak to that. But what is the behind-the-scenes negotiations going on now that seems to, at least on the surface, address the concerns of opponents of the merger?
Well, there have been reports that one of the services that T-Mobile and Sprint offer is what are called reseller services, where they actually lease spectrum to another entity that then resells it in the marketplace. Boost is one of those services. It's used disproportionately by low-income people in communities of color. And there's a thought that the 7 million subscribers that rely on Boost for services, and Boost would be spun off, and then another entity, there's been talk of Dish or Charter, would come in and bring some of their assets to create a new competitor in the marketplace. And we're very skeptical of this for a number of reasons, one of which is because it just takes a considerable investment in time and money to actually create a company that could be competitive at that level. So you would not see any, you know, even if that were to happen, you wouldn't see those sorts of competitive pressures in the marketplace for a number of years. And by that time, it may be too late for us to keep prices down and keep services at a level of quality that we would like to see.
That was Tim Carr, Senior Director of Strategy and Communications with the media democracy group Free Press. Learn more about the reasons groups across the U.S. are opposing the T-Mobile-Sprint merger by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Concern about the climate crisis now ranks first or second among a majority of Americans, according to recent public opinion polls. That's in part due to the high-profile coverage given to newly elected U.S. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York and her support for the Green New Deal, which has been championed by the youth-initiated and led Sunrise Movement. But few people active in the climate movement make the connection between that crisis and militarism and war. Ellen Barfield is one person who does. She's an Army veteran who served in the 1990s, serves on the board of the War Resisters League, the U.S. affiliate of War Resisters International, which will celebrate its centennial in 2020. Barfield is also the former vice president of the group Veterans for Peace. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Barfield in Washington, D.C., during a break from a climate meeting they were both attending. Here, Barfield explains the link she sees between the two issues and the urgency she feels to take action on both.
What we're doing programmatically is we have been for quite a few years working with the police war games and police weapons expos that happen in way too many cities. And you may know the 1033 program where the U.S. government gives and or sells at a very low rate military equipment, surplus military equipment, to domestic police. It's no wonder they show up in their riot gear with their tanks, and it's horrendous.
Like in Ferguson.
Like in Ferguson, exactly. A really new one is Building Anti-Militarist Futures, that's it, BAMF. And it's basically a teach-in about helping young high school, mostly, students recognize the extreme pervasiveness of the military recruiters. They're in their schools 24/7 and challenging that whole mindset that that's your only economic opportunity.
For the last 5 years at least, I know you've been involved in climate struggles, trying to stop fossil fuel projects. And how does that fit into your, if it does, into your nonviolent work with War Resisters League?
Well, it totally does. I have always considered, especially anti-nuclear weapons work, but in general, anti-war work is very much environmental work. War is obviously horrendous for the environment. Even just preparing for war is horrendous for the environment. It happens that the U.S. Pentagon is the single biggest entity in the world burning fossil fuel. Massive, massive quantities of fossil fuels. And a lot of the wars in the last while have been to keep control of the oil and gas around the world. How did our oil get under their sand? You may remember that from challenging the Iraq war. The war economy and the whole war mindset. The stuff on the border about they're invading and how dare they, and they're leaving because climate change is flooding out where they live, but also because their communities are awash in violence. And it may be gangs that young people who lived in the U.S. and then got kicked out and formed a gang where they went back to because their family was gone and that's all they had, that's some of it. And just the terrible violence that the U.S. military training of Latin American troops has created. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. People leave because they can't live at home, not because they're greedy and want to come here where the streets are paved with gold. I started working on specifically climate stuff because clearly, it was the other existential crisis aside from possible nuclear war. So I think they're very connected.
Most people don't make that connection.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Green New Deal for a minute. Yeah. This is a proposal, a resolution, not legislation yet, proposed by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and from New York and Senator Markey from Massachusetts. And I understand that you have some criticisms.
I do. I think it is a fabulous idea, and I'm thrilled with all the youthful energy. And I've been in the halls of Congress for a couple of the big sunrise things. They're glad to have us old folks there lending support, but it's largely youth, and that's exciting, tremendously exciting. And to connect the terrible economic disparities getting nothing but worse. And hooray that the Green New Deal is very clear that not only must we straighten up our act climate and energy-wise, but that must afford jobs and training and help to the most disadvantaged, the people who've had the hardest time for way too long. That's fabulous. However, they are not saying anything about what I just said about the Pentagon. And it's not just the Green New Deal, it's the big greens. And the green effort, the environmental effort, doesn't in general talk at all about militarism and the Pentagon. And especially with the Green New Deal, because the answer back to the Green New Deal from those who claim to be sympathetic but are like, is we can't afford it, and technically that's true, but that's because more than half our tax dollars are going into the already massive Pentagon. We spend more than the next seven nations behind us, and those are the only ones that could conceivably be any real military threat to us. It's just crazy, and we have 800 to 1,000 bases in over 150 countries around the world. Imagine how expensive that is. It's just massive, massive amounts of money. We got to suck it back. The Greens in general and the Green New Deal, just say it. I'm not asking them to go surround the Pentagon, but just say that that's a piece of what's going on. We can most assuredly afford to do those things if we will just change our priorities.
That was Ellen Barfield, board member of the War Resisters League, and an activist with the climate group Beyond Extreme Energy. Learn more about the links between the climate crisis and militarism by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZBC in Newton, Massachusetts, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KMXT in Kodiak, Alaska, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.